We're studying in Galatians chapter 4, and this is our second study of the paragraph that starts in verse 8. In Peter's first or second letter, in talking about people who have come to know the truth and turned away from it, that they're like a dog who has returned to its vomit, and to a sow or a pig that's returned to its wallow. And that actually is a reference back to one of the Proverbs, where it says that the fool is like a dog who returns to its vomit, and says something to the effect that there really isn't much hope for a person in that category or way of thought. And that's actually what we're dealing with in Galatians chapter 4. People who made a profession of faith in the truth, gave every indication that they did believe it when Paul went through their preaching, but now they have turned around and left the God who had called them by grace into this grace. And in verses 8 through 11, he is actually expressing the situation that they're in contrast to the one that they had been in, because verse 8 that we looked at last time points backwards. In verse 7, he concluded with the statement, you're an heir of God, or an heir through God. But then he points back to before Paul came to Galatia with the gospel. At that time, they didn't know God, and they were slaves to those entities that claim to be gods but are not by their very essence. They have no capacity to exercise the kind of power that you depend on a God to exercise. So that was their former condition. We spent all of our time last time looking at that. This evening we're going to look at least part of verse 9, where he says, but now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how is it that you turn back again to the weak and worthless elemental things to which you desire to be enslaved all over again? And what he's talking about there is a dog going back to its vomit. I know that's a gross mental picture, but it's designed to be. Because the issue is that you're only made sick enough to throw up when there is something in your system that is so opposed to your life that your body feels like you need to get this out, it's going to kill you. So you do, and a dog does that. And it turns right around and laps right back up. In a very real sense, anybody who's come to grace through faith and has experienced at least the initial response of God to those who depend on His grace, for them to turn and walk away is dumb. It's just silly, because He is life and that's where we get our life. So this evening what we're going to do is we're going to look into this declaration of what is the present case. Before he came, he said, you were slaves to not gods, to things that claim to be gods but can't exercise the power that you need for a God to exercise in your case. The only reason people ever turn to a God is because they don't have the capacity in themselves to handle whatever it is they're facing. That's the whole point. That's why in the Old Testament you'll run into constant questions from God to people who are resisting Him or rejecting Him in the favor of false gods. He'll say, can they deliver you? Can they do anything for you? He said, my arm's not short that it can't save, but what about theirs? So what we're going to do is we're going to look at least in the beginning, this issue of why he says you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God. Because it's obvious that he's saying both are true, but he's also emphasizing that it's more important to be known by God than it is for you to know God, in terms of which one is the more critical factor. So that's where we're headed. I'm calling verse 9 statement, but now that you have come to know God, an assumed statement of their current reality. And I'm calling it assumed on the basis of verse 11, the end of the paragraph, where he says, I fear for you that perhaps I've labored over you in vain. And then in verse 19 and 20, my children with whom I'm again in labor until Christ is formed in you, I wish to be present with you and change my tone because I'm perplexed about you. Now, the perplexity and the fear of verse 11 are being driven by the facts of chapter 1, where if you preach a different gospel than salvation by grace through faith, you're going to be under a curse, an eternal curse. And the Galatians are being led by the false teachers into believing a false gospel, and there's only a little step from believing something to proclaiming it. So what Paul is obviously dealing with is the problem of whether or not their profession of faith and their regeneration, new birth experience when he came through Galatia in the beginning is actually a valid thing. Because John said in 1 John, they went out from us, but they were not of us. Because if they had been of us, they would no doubt have remained with us. There is this issue in the scriptures that if your faith is a God-produced thing, that it's a permanent work on his part, and that protects you from the drift. If the drift sets in, it doesn't challenge whether God's work is permanent. What it challenges is whether the work was done. And that's the issue in Galatians. I'm saying in verse 9 that he's assuming it was done for the sake of his presentation to them. But it's an assumption that he's not real certain of in chapter 4. Now, when we get over to chapter 5 or 6, somewhere in the latter part of the book, he says, I'm persuaded. And the text literally says, I have been persuaded about you. What that means is, as Paul wrestled with this whole thing, God apparently stepped in and persuaded them that they were really born again when he preached to them. Their profession of faith was a legitimate thing. But in chapter 4, there is this tension where he seriously hopes it's true. He wants it to be true, but their behavior is a revelation of the fact that might not be. But he's going to assume it is. And so verse 9 is a statement about the way it is now on the assumption that they did believe what he preached to them when he preached Christ crucified. He's not at this point convinced that it actually describes them, but he's willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. That's based on partly Jesus' teaching in Luke 8, where he talks about people who believe for a little while. The Bible doesn't teach that faith that saves you is a little while kind of thing. So that's what's going on in the text. The second issue that is raised here is in verse 8, in their former state, he says, you didn't know God. In this verse 9, he says, but now you've come to know God, or rather, to be known by God. The thing that's significant about that is that the word in verse 8 for knowledge and the word in verse 9 for knowledge are not the same. When we did our study last time, we talked about the knowledge of verse 8 that is knowledge based on facts, interpretation of those facts, and conclusions drawn because of that interpretation of those facts, so that out of the conclusion, you now know. That's the kind of knowledge that is heavily dependent on how well the facts are interpreted. And he says they didn't know God. In other words, he's not contradicting Romans 1 where he says everybody knows. But he is contradicting the fact that they know God because of the facts. Because he says in Romans 1, the facts are so clear that you're without excuse. The facts are so clear that you know that those who do these things are worthy of death, but you do them anyway. The facts are clear. But you have messed those facts up by applying an interpretation that basically comes out of well, I don't want to hear this, so I'm going to choose to interpret it this way, and then draw your conclusions. And you can draw any kind of conclusions you want to, given that process. That's the kind of knowledge, he said, they didn't have of God. They had the facts, but they didn't interpret them properly, and as a consequence, they had no knowledge of God. And because they didn't know the true God, they became slaves to gods that didn't actually have any characteristics of deity. False gods. But he says, now you have come to know God. Now this word for knowledge is the one that Jesus used in Matthew 7:23. Very famous passage. Matthew 7 is part of the Sermon on the Mount, and in verse 23, Jesus is bringing to a conclusion a statement about how things are going to be in the final judgment, where people are saying to him, Lord, we did this in your name, and we did that in your name, and we did this in your name, and these doings in your name have qualified us for inheriting your kingdom. And the king says, depart from me, I never knew you. And the king is Jesus, and for him to say, I never knew you, seems to be a contradiction of his omniscience. Except that it's not, because of the way the words are used. If Jesus had said, I never knew you, with the word in verse 8 of Galatians 4, he would have been lying. Because God knows every individual's facts, he interprets those facts absolutely accurately, even down to the joints and the marrow, down to the thoughts and intents of the heart. God makes no mistakes in the facts or in the interpretation of the facts, and therefore there are no flaws in the conclusions he draws. He knows every human being who has ever lived with that kind of precision and detail, so that when he summons them before the great white throne judgment, where justice will be the standard, they will be held accountable for every idle word that they spoke. They will be held accountable for every motivation, for every hidden thing of the heart, every secret that they tried to keep secret in terms of why they were doing what they were doing. He knows all that and is going to bring it up, so that anybody that stands before the great white throne will absolutely have nothing that they can say to refute the judgment of the judge. Because he knows, absolutely knows. So how is it that Jesus can say, as the judge, as the king of the kingdom, depart from me, I never knew you? Well, there is another word in the Greek for knowledge, and that's the one that's used in verse 9 of Galatians 4. And that word for knowledge is a word that has to do with a relational interaction kind of knowledge. Chapter 4, verse 9. This is the word that the scriptures use when it says that a man knew his wife and she bore a son or a daughter, whatever. The knowledge, obviously, is a euphemistic term, but it's talking about that intimacy of relational knowledge that has produced a pregnancy. Well, that kind of knowledge is not intellectual primarily, though your mind's never out of gear with knowledge. But it does depend on a very real relational reality, so that you can never say of somebody, I knew you, if you never had a relationship with them. You may know all the facts of their life. You may be able to interpret those facts accurately and draw all kinds of conclusions about that individual, but you never knew them in a relational way, because there was never a relationship there. And when Jesus says that he's going to say to people who are basing their approach to participation in the kingdom based on what they did, I did this in your name, I did this in your name, it was for you, I did this. He's going to reject all of the, I'm qualified because I qualified myself, because I did all this stuff. He's going to reject them by saying, we never had a relationship. Get out of here. I never knew you. You would never lower the barrier and let me have a relationship with you. You would not. And as a consequence, I didn't have one. I never knew you. Get out of here. That's Matthew 7:23. So when he says, depart from me, I never knew you, he's not saying he didn't know everything about him. He's not saying that there was some kind of flaw in the way he interpreted those facts. He's saying, I didn't have a personal relationship with you. And because I didn't have a personal relationship with you, I never had a relational knowledge of you. So by saying it that way, we have an indication here of what Paul is talking about in Galatians 4:9. You have come to know God means the barriers did come down in the relationship between you and God, and you have been given the opportunity to enter into a relationship with Him. You have come to know God. It doesn't mean that you know a whole lot of facts about Him. It doesn't mean that you suddenly are a master or a doctor of theology in regard to the truth about God. But it does mean that you have a relationship with Him. It may be a very minor thing in terms of the amount of time you've had to spend and all of that. But the fact is, the barriers came down, the relationship was established. And you were given the ability to interact with God on a relational, in a relational way. And of course, in chapter 4, verse 6, we have the alternative. Because he says the crucial issue is not that you have been given the ability to relate to God. The crucial thing is that God has been given the ability to relate to you. In other words, you've come to know God, but the real issue is you're known by God. Because the issue in relational knowledge is what each individual is putting into the relationship. What kind of interaction each person's contributing to the relational interaction. And when you compare what human beings put into the relationship when it comes to God and what He gets out of it to what He puts into the relationship and what they get out of it, there's no comparison. I mean, I'm not making light of the fact that God wants us to know Him, and when we permit that to happen by trusting what He says in the gospel, I'm not saying that He doesn't get something out of that. I mean, the Bible says that there's joy in the presence of the angels over every sinner that repents. So apparently it affects God when we have a relationship with Him. He gets something out of that relationally. But whatever it is He gets out of it isn't new to Him. It's not a, whoa, I didn't realize this is what... I mean, with God, nah. But alternatively, if we are known by God, that means that what He has done in terms of inputting into us, because there's a relationship now, is highly significant. And that's why chapter 4, verse 6 is such a critical statement. Because Paul's doctrine is this: as soon as you lower the barrier, as soon as you allow God to relate to you, because you believe the gospel, you trust His promise, as soon as you believe Him, He puts His Spirit in your body. And the impact of that is that you suddenly have an Abba Daddy relationship with God. That's a huge thing for God to do for us. Whatever He gets out of our relating to Him is not really new to Him. It's real, but it's not new. But for us, a person who had no knowledge of God and was alienated from the life of God, to all of a sudden have the Spirit of God dwelling in his body and have access to the life of God and the joy of the life, that's a whole new experience. It's not the kind of thing that you can actually explain to somebody, but it is a real experiential fact. So when he says, but now you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, he's actually emphasizing what happens when a person enters into a relationship with God. Because God is not idle, and this is not an intellectual exercise. That's why people often will make the comment like, I mean, it's kind of a cliche now, that Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. Most people couldn't tell you the difference between them. But the fact is, you can practice all kinds of religious practices, and you can serve diligently all kinds of things that are not God, but you think they are, or they claim to be. Those kind of things can go on in the life of anybody and be totally ignorant of the truth about God, or totally ignorant of God. But you can't lower the barrier and allow God to have a relationship with you without Him doing some significant things to you, for you, in you, because His love has been allowed to do these things. So, in the Bible, the lowering of the barrier is the basic issue of believing His promise. This is the promise that He promised us, eternal life, based on what Jesus did at Calvary to eliminate the legal issues so that God could be gracious and give you all of the stuff that He wants to give you that you can never be qualified in yourself. You don't deserve them. He doesn't just dribble them out to you based on how faithful you are, that kind of thing. It's grace. And He just does stuff because He loves us and because He wants to. And that's the whole issue of being known by God. So, what Paul is doing in verse 9 is saying, the present circumstance is this. You have experienced what it means for God to have some input in your life. If you want proof of that, notice what he says in verse 15 of this chapter. This is the next paragraph, but we'll be weeks getting there. He says in verse 15, where then is that sense of blessing that you had? Well, what's he talking about? He's talking about that sense of blessedness that every person experiences as soon as they lower the barriers to the relationship. As soon as they trust in the gospel, God does some things. Verse 6, sends the Spirit into their hearts, crying Abba. This is a real action on God's part, and it produces a real sense of blessedness in the hearts of, and minds of those that experience it, and they do experience it. Now, the experience isn't a settled experience. Verse 15 assumes that it came and went. Where is that sense of blessedness that you had? But the fact is, he's assuming they did have it because they have come to know God and God has come to know them in a relational way. So that's the statement of the present reality. They have been known by God. They have entered into the things that God does for every person who will allow Him to do them by lowering the barrier of distrust that keeps the relationship at a distance. That's the foundation for this question, then, that the statement turns into. But now that you have come to know God, or rather, to be known by God, that's the opening issue. The question is this: how is it that you turn back again to the weak and worthless elemental things? Those things to which you desire to be enslaved all over again. How is this? What Paul is doing is, he is saying, in a very real sense, that they desire to be enslaved all over again. In other words, they want to return to the condition of verse 8. They want to go back to the bondage that exists in the mind and heart of an individual who has more being thrown at him than he can handle in life, is desperate to have some help, and turns to something that is called God and seeks help from this executor power known as God, and have that God do absolutely nothing. That's the bondage of having more being thrown at you than you can handle in life and having nowhere to turn to get any real help. That's not to say people don't pray when it happens. It's not to say that they don't do all kinds of religious stuff when it happens. It is to say this: nothing good is done for them when life is overwhelming and they turn to a not God. Paul's saying, how is it that you want to go back to that kind of experience? This is the essence of the dog turning back to its own vomit. In verse 8, you guys were living, he says, in a situation where life was throwing more at you than you could handle. You were responding to the desperation in your life by turning to things that were called gods by you. But when you prayed to them and when you offered sacrifices to them and you cried out for help from them, they could do nothing because they're not God. They're not gods. They have no power to exercise on your behalf. So the desperation was not mitigated. The situation was not addressed. You were enslaved by your fears and your impotence and the fact that nothing's happening. And you want to go back to that. That's what he's saying. How is it that you desire to be enslaved all over again? The issue in the turning, in verse 9, the statement, how is it that you turn back again to? That verb translated turn back is an intensified form of a verb that means to turn back. But it's intensified by the addition of a preposition. It's the preposition epi. And it means you turn back upon. You fall back on this. And then the word that's translated to, the weak and worthless element, that's the word epi again. So what Paul has done is he's taken this idea that you're turning back to, throwing your weight back upon something, and he emphasizes it in the verb, and then he re-emphasizes it by adding the preposition to it, so that the picture is that these people are actually casting themselves upon their former situation. They're turning back to the weak and worthless elemental things. They're going back to the gods that don't have any power to exercise. They're going back to the desperation and the impotence and the frustration and the rage and all of the fear and all. They're going back to that. How is it that you're throwing yourself back upon that? How can this be? Paul is astonished. I call this in my outline the incomprehensible desire. How in the world could you want to go back to your vomit? How could you? It made you so sick that you were going to die if you didn't get rid of this. And you got rid of it. But something has happened and now you think, oh, I can re-ingest that and it won't be like last time. Oh, how can you be so blind, he said. What are they throwing themselves back upon? Well, he says weak and worthless elements, translated elemental things. But we've already run into the elements. You remember in verse 3, we were children, we were held in bondage under the elemental things. Remember back then when we were studying that, I made this statement about that. The bondage of the elemental things is a bondage that's directly tied to the law. He says, you want to be in bondage to the elemental things? In verse 4, God sent forth His Son born under the law so that He might redeem those that were under the law. So the elemental things boils down to the law. And the essential issue of law is this. Law is when a God makes a demand, and you try to obey it in order to get the God to do whatever it is you want Him to do. The God has the power to help you, but He's not going to help you unless you do something that He's told you to do. And if you do it, then you'll get His help. That's the law. Do this, and I'll let you live. Don't do it, and you'll die. That's the law. So when he says you're going back to the weak and worthless elements, he's talking about going back to a relational reality with the gods, the executors of power, the person or persons that you're depending on to help you deal with all of those things about your life that are beyond your capacity. You're going back to a practice of a God who says, please me, do what I tell you, obey me, and then we'll talk about whether I'll meet the needs that you have. How can you do this? He says. Now, keep this in mind. The Galatians are Gentiles. They've never technically been under Jewish law. But Paul says their turn to Jewish law was in effect turning back to the older principle of gods who say, if you want me to exercise my power on your behalf, you're going to have to obey me. That was the testimony of 1,500 years of legal history by God over the nation of Israel. You want my help in the land? You're going to have to obey my law. If you don't obey my law, I'll kick you out of the land. If I kick you out of the land, none of your needs are going to be met. If you want me to meet your needs, you're going to have to keep my law. You're going to have to obey me. And, of course, most everybody thinks, well, you know, that's what the law meant. Well, Paul says, no, that's not what the law meant. That's the facts, but you've got to be interpreted properly. And the proper interpretation of the law was that God gave it not to get you to obey him, because he knew better than that. He knew you weren't. He knew you couldn't. He gave the law not to get you to obey, but to get you to understand that you can't use that kind of a principle with God and get anywhere, because the weakness is in the fact that you can't do it. If you could do what God demands of you and get his power to be exercised on your behalf, well then, fine, life would be by the law. But the law was addressing dead people. They don't have the capacity to obey it. So whether you're a Jew or a Gentile or whatever, as long as you're going back to this principle of, I'll get power from the God or the gods if I do what they tell me, if I satisfy them, if I appease them, if I bring whatever sacrifices or whatever they require, then I'll get the help I need. If that's the principle, you have fallen upon a sword called weak and beggarly elements. Now, my proof that the elemental issue is falling back on performance issues is verse 10. Because in verse 10, his statement is, verse 9, you want to be enslaved to this all again, and my proof is this, you observe days and months and seasons and years. What does that mean? It means that the gods, the God, whatever you're depending on, has made certain rules for you to follow on certain days, certain months, certain seasons, and certain years. And the fact that you're approaching God on the basis of obedience to his demands for the days and the months and the years and the seasons is proof that you're still functioning under the delusion that you can get the help you need from the God if you will just obey him. And like I said, the problem is not that God wouldn't give you what you need if you'd obey him. The problem is you can't obey him. It doesn't matter what he tells you to do, you are not going to do it properly. That's the flaw of sin in the life of a human being. Everything we do is flawed. And God looks at that and says, nah, that ain't obedience. That's not obedience. You can't, don't come in here telling me you've obeyed me, so now you want me to help you based on that. That wasn't obedience. I told you to do this with this kind of an attitude and this kind of action, and you took this kind of action, added that kind of an attitude, and now you're calling it obedience. He said, it ain't obedience. I'm not going to accept that. So, if you're going to approach the whole issue of whether you're going to get help from God based on what you do for him, forget it. You've fallen on a sword. It's called weak and beggarly. What is weak and beggarly? It means it ain't going to work. It can't. The whole issue here is, what is the root? What is the foundation? The issue in verse 8 was, In the former time, before you heard the gospel of Jesus, before you believed the promise of God, before he gave you his spirit, before you had any union in his life, before all that, you were living lives of despair, disaster, incrementally growing, horrible stuff. And every time you looked for help from some god, you were frustrated. You didn't get the help you needed. That's what it was like before. Now, however, you have allowed God to come to know you. He has sent His Spirit into your body. He dwells in you. He has created an Abba-Daddy child relationship between you and the Father. And yet you're willing to jettison that and go back to this old notion that the real way to relate to God is obey Him. Then you'll get the help you need. That is not how daddies treat their children. Daddies do not require of their children a legitimate obedience before they will meet their needs. They may require some things in order for the kids to get some of the perks and bennies and all that kind of thing. I mean, there are going to be rules in the house. But the fact is, any daddy worth his salt as a daddy is going to make sure that the child has the health that he needs, as long as it's the daddy's capacity to make it, the food, the drink, the covering, the emotional security, the love. Any daddy worth his salt is going to do that for his child regardless of the child's attitude toward the daddy. That's the whole point of grace, is that you have come to know a God of grace, and this God of grace now knows you, and He starts dealing with you by grace, which means you never approach Him on the basis, well, God, you kind of owe me this because I did all this stuff for you. Never. The issue is, but Daddy, I got to have this or I'm going to die. And if Daddy agrees with you, you got it. Because He's not going to let you die. You're one of His children. So that's the issue of what it's supposed to be like. Well, Paul says this is the present circumstance. You have the possibility of a relationship with the Father where He will do for you what needs to be done for you. His power is available to you to meet the real needs of your circumstance. Not the stuff you think is necessary, but the stuff that's necessary. You have His power available to that. He's going to exercise it by grace in your case. And you want to turn that whole relational issue into a formal legal arrangement where you get what you want because you give Him what He demands. And that just destroys the relationship. There is no relationship between persons on that basis. There's no interaction between persons on that kind of a basis. So what Paul is doing in Galatians 4:9 is establishing the present state of affairs. Your faith in the gospel made it possible for the Father to become your daddy. He has sent His Spirit into your hearts. You are His heir by His work. Don't turn that into some kind of a legal demand performance, get what you want basis. That's turning back to a weak and beggarly principle, and it'll destroy you. It's like lapping up your own vomit. It won't work. Can't work. It's weak and beggarly. So, the sad reality is that slavish adherence to rules initially induced a violent sickness, and any return to that same principle of adherence to rules in order to get will bring the same violent reaction. When a person turns to a God that cannot exercise power, the ultimate pain is inevitable. That's what he's driving at.